I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. In the fall of 2011, members of a splinter Amish group forcibly shaved the beards of a handful of Amish men during a series of attacks in northeastern Ohio. At trial, one of the main questions was whether the acts constituted hate crime. The case of the renegade Amish is one of three stories we're covering this hour, all of a religious nature. We'll talk to a former Mormon missionary about his misadventures in Belgium, and we'll look at the influence of the phonograph on Protestant black preaching during the Great Depression. Three segments, three fascinating stories about people and their faith. That's next on Midday. First, the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone. Dan Rodericks here, and welcome back to Midday. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day, listening here on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF out in Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPO, the Ocean City area, and the Eastern Shore of Maryland, streaming live online through WYPR.org. As you can imagine, we see a lot of new books here at Midday in our office. They arrive every day, every week. And every so often, we tie three of them together for you. And that's one of these hours. In this hour, we're going to be devoting each of our segments to a different story, all of them tied to religion. We'll be speaking with religious commentator Lerone Martin about how, this is some religious history for you here, how the phonograph significantly shaped modern African-American Christianity during the 20th century, especially during the Great Depression. Great black preachers on wax, you might say. That's coming up a little bit later in this hour. We'll also speak with Craig Harleen, a former Mormon missionary who has written a memoir about his misadventures as a missionary for the Mormons in Belgium back in the 1970s. But at the top here, we turn to the Amish. Apart from beards, bonnets, and buggies, nonviolence is a signature of Amish identity. Many will remember in 2006 when the Amish were in the spotlight for their quick and astonishing forgiveness after a non-Amish gunman shot 10 girls in an Amish schoolhouse in Pennsylvania. That story touched the lives of thousands, if not millions, of people around the globe. But in the fall of 2001, something quite different and strange came out of northeastern Ohio, a string of beard-cutting attacks. You might remember these. The beard-cutting attacks involved five different assaults. Acting in groups, the assailants forced their way into victims' homes and forcibly shaved off the beards of Amish men and cut the hair of the men and Amish women. The assailants were all members of a community in Ohio that had broken away from the larger Amish community there. And they were under the direction of a controlling patriarch named Sam Mullett. The assailants were eventually charged and convicted of federal hate crimes. The convictions were later overturned. Our guest in this segment of the show has been on Midday before, Donald Craybill, a senior fellow at Elizabethtown College. He's written several books about Amish culture. Last time he was on our show, we spent a good deal of time with him talking about this. His latest book, Donald Craybill's latest book, is Renegade Amish, Beard-Cutting, Hate Crimes, and the Trial of the Bergholtz Barbers. It's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Donald Craybill, I want to welcome you back to the Midday show.
Thank you. My pleasure. My pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, Don, it's nice to have you back. And we didn't talk about this case the last time you were on the air. I forget when that was exactly. This was in 2011. And for this story, we need to go to Bergholtz, Ohio, right? And talk about Mr. Mullett, Samuel Mullett. So why don't you take us there for the beginning of this story?
Well, Bergholtz, Ohio is located in Jefferson County in the very east end of Ohio, not far from Pittsburgh. And Bergholtz is a small village, and Samuel Mullett, an Amishman, set up a settlement there in 1995. He purchased 800 acres, and members of his family started moving there. And essentially, it evolved very much like a clan. Most of the families, 25 families or so, were members of his extended family. And the first 10 years were rather uneventful. He was ordained minister and then ordained bishop. And then in the spring and summer of 2006, he became very vindictive and arbitrarily excommunicated 8 or 9 families, which caused a stir in the wider Amish community. That led to a large meeting in September of 2006 of 300 Amish bishops and ministers who voted unanimously that they would not accept his excommunications. They would nullify his excommunications, which meant that the families who had been excommunicated capriciously and arbitrarily by Mullet could now join other Amish congregations. And I think that act led Mullet and the Klan to become very insular, to withdraw from the larger Amish world, and it sowed the seeds of his anger and hate that led eventually then in 2011 to 5 different attacks on Amish people who had criticized his leadership and his practices in the Klan, in the community there at Burgholz.
And all those people, I assume, had left his Klan. They lived away from him now.
They lived away from him, but they had not all, only, only one of them had actually lived in the Klan. These were outside leaders who criticized his practices and were people who had family living there and knew about the practices, but had not lived there themselves. So he was basically targeting 5 outspoken critics of the practices of the Burgholz group.
The attacks that he organized, we all came to know them as beard cuttings. We thought this was really, really a strange development in the Amish community. But the significance of the cutting of beards and the cutting of hair for us, please.
Well, the significance of the beard is that it's a symbol of masculine Amish identity. It's a religious symbol. There are many references to it in the Old Testament that Amish leaders would cite. It's taken for granted as a symbol of Amish religion so much that it's rarely even talked about or even in the rules and regulations, it's just taken for granted. And 2 of these victims were bishops, and it's a very shaming thing. It's very embarrassing to have your beard cut because they have to stand up and lead church services, and it's going to take several months, if not a year, to grow a decent-looking beard back again. So he explicitly, it was a cunning and smart thing. It was a really good symbol if you want to attack someone and cut right into the fundamental of their religious identity, so to speak. Mm.
So this was Mullet's vendetta. Would you call it a vendetta, these attacks?
Yes, I would. There were also families involved, and so some of it related to family disputes, but it was retaliation for their criticism of the way he was operating the community. He began calling all other Amish hypocrites. He began speaking very disparagingly against them and really created an ideology where the Burgholz Amish, his Amish, were the pure Amish and all the other Amish were impure. And so in the court, when I testified, the defense kept saying, well, these were acts of compassion, that they were Burgholz was being compassionate to the other people to help straighten them out, to get them back on the true path of genuine Amish faith, which, in my judgment, was simply bogus. I don't consider the Burgholz Amish Amish. I mean, they separated themselves clearly from all the basic principles of Amish faith. They haven't held church services since 2010. In the book, I identify more than 2 dozen distinctive practices that they follow, which are absolutely contrary to Orthodox Amish religion.
And before we leave that and talk about the court case, excommunication, you used the word capricious before. just a sanction not meant to be imposed lightly is how the greater Amish community viewed that and why they criticized him and did not honor the excommunication he had imposed.
That's correct. Typically, if there's excommunication, which leads to shunning, eventually some form of social isolation, it's a slow process. Over several months, the offender would be given many opportunities to recant, so to speak, and confess. But in Mullet's case, if people disagreed with him, if they were outspoken about their disagreement, he just arbitrarily excommunicated them, which, again, is completely out of order in terms of normal Amish protocol.
We're speaking with Donald B. Craybill, author of Renegade Amish, Beard-Cutting Hate Crimes in the Trial of the Bergholtz Barbers. It's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Tell us what happened when it got to federal court. They were brought up on charges, Mullet and others brought up on federal hate crime charges.
Right. They were charged with federal hate crimes. And the reason the federal government became involved was that the victims and offenders and sites of the attacks were in actually five different counties in Ohio, and it would have been complicated to try to prosecute them separately. So they were charged with federal hate crimes under the 2009 Matthew Shepard or Shepard Byrd Hate Crimes Act, mm-hmm. which says that you need three things to be convicted of a federal hate crime under that act. Number one, there must be interstate commerce involved. Number two, there must be some form of bodily injury. And number three, the offender must be motivated because of the victim's six things: the victim's gender, their sexual orientation, their race, their religion, their ethnicity, or a disability that they may have. So in this case, the prosecution argued that religion was a significant motivating factor, and they had evidence of interstate commerce because of some of the scissors and the clippers, the battery-operated clippers, and some other things that were manufactured out of state. And the interesting question was bodily injury. In the statute, in the Shepherd Bird statute, it says that one type of bodily injury is disfigurement. And it says disfigurement, however temporary. And likely, if the word temporary hadn't been in the statute, they wouldn't have been convicted, because you could say the jury agreed that cutting a beard was disfigurement. But you could say, well, it's the beard's going to grow back, so it's not permanent. But the statute says temporary disfigurement. And so that was the clincher that led the jury to convict them of federal hate crimes. Now, they were also convicted of other crimes, such as being part of a conspiracy to commit a crime, lying to the FBI, and concealing evidence.
Don, our time is short here. I just want to mention that since your book was published, an appellate court reversed the convictions. Is that correct?
An appellate court at Cincinnati reversed a three-judge panel reversed the convictions in a 2-1 sort of sharply divided decision, reversed the hate crime convictions. And the other convictions still stand for conspiracy, for lying to the FBI, for concealing evidence. And now the case is back in the hands of the district court in Cleveland, federal court. And they need to decide. They have several options. They could petition U.S. Supreme Court. They could have a retrial of some of the defendants, or they could resentence them, the ones that are presently in prison, based on the crimes that are still standing, which would likely reduce their sentences.
One last question.
So we're kind of in extra innings, so to speak.
Yeah, I see
legally,
what you mean. Yeah.
And it's still uncertain how this is going to play out. But what has happened is this is no longer about religion and about Amish, but it's really about, has become through the appeals process and the appellate court decision, it's now about how future hate crimes in America will be prosecuted under Shepherd Byrd. And the appellate court took a more restrictive interpretation in contrast to the district court, which is more expansive. So this case has significance for all of us particularly those people that are protected under the six categories of the Shepherd Bird Statute.
My last question for you, Don Crabill, is where do things stand now with Mullet and his community?
Mullet's still in prison. He's in Texarkana, Texas. About half of the defendants have been released from prison. There were six women who had only one-year sentences, and so the women and two or three men have been released. There are about 100 people in the community yet. Six of his young adult grandsons, who are ages 18 to 22 or so, have left the community. But there's a lot of young children there, and he is still directing things from prison, the bishop is. The future of the community is very uncertain. I would say it's a time of sort of uncertainty and chaos in terms of leadership, because all the ministers are in prison. Yeah. So this is simply unheard of in the history of the Amish, to have a group acting like this and to have all their ministers in federal prison.
We've been speaking
it's really bizarre.
We've been speaking with Donald Crabill, a distinguished college professor and senior fellow at the Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. Johns Hopkins University Press is the publisher of his latest book on the Amish, this one called Renegade Amish: Beard Cutting, Hate Crimes, and the Trial of the Bergholtz Barbers. Don Crabill, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
We'll continue our conversations. Our next story about religion. Craig Harleen, a professor of history at Brigham Young University, a former Mormon missionary. A new memoir, he recounts the many misadventures he had during his mission to Belgium in the 1970s. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. That music you're hearing is from the Broadway hit musical The Book of Mormon, a send-up of Mormon missionaries and their works overseas. Our guest in this segment of the show, Craig Harleen, knows a lot about Mormon missionary work because he was a Mormon missionary once, and a new memoir, I love the title of this book, Way Below the Angels, The Pretty Clearly Troubled But Not Even Close to Tragic Confessions of a Real Live Mormon Missionary. In that memoir, Craig recounts stories from his missionary days in Belgium in the 1970s. The book gives a humorous and insightful look at what it's like to be a missionary for the Mormons, from how it feels to be rejected over and over again to what it's like to go to a foreign country with conversion in mind. Craig Harleen is a professor of European history at Brigham Young. His wife and three children have also served abroad as Mormon missionaries. He joins us here on the Midday Show to talk about his memoir. So, Craig Harleen, we want to welcome you to the Midday Show on WYPR.
Thanks a lot, Dan. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. Sounds like a book you've been meaning to write for, three decades or more?
Way before the musical, I promise.
Yeah, way before the musical. But that musical must have got you thinking, it's time for me to share some of what I know about this experience.
Yeah, maybe it did, in the presidential candidacy of Mitt Romney and, the kind of general increasing curiosity, I suppose, about Mormons. So, yeah, it seemed like a good time, but I've been wanting to write it since the early 80s, at least, about 5 years after I came home.
When in a young Mormon boy's life is he informed that he'll have to take on missionary work?
Well, when you grow up Mormon, you kind of expect that you're going to do that when you turn 19, and now you can go when you're 18. But so I kind of grew up just supposing I would do that. I don't know that there was a single moment. It just always seemed to be there.
Okay. Was it always presented as this exciting opportunity, a chance to travel overseas, for instance?
Oh, sure it was. And you didn't even have to do a real hard sell. A lot of the fellows who came home, those are the ones who really caught my imagination, because they come home and they speak in their new language and they've got all these wonderful stories. And so, yeah, that was definitely what I wanted
okay.
to do.
Okay. So it seemed exciting to you when you hit high school and got ready for missionary work, but who assigned you to Belgium?
Well, you submit an application to church headquarters in Salt Lake, and that's where the assignments are made, and you really don't have much say in where you're going to go.
Okay, so you got it. What did you get, a letter in the mail someday? Or called?
That's right.
It said you're going to Belgium.
You get a big white letter in the mail, a big packet, and the rumor was the thicker it was, the more likely it was to be a foreign mission, right, because you had more papers to fill out.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, so mine was really thick.
So Belgium, when you were told Belgium, you thought, What do I know about Belgium? Belgian waffles, Belgian endive. What do I know about Belgium?
At the time, I didn't know any of that even. You know, I mean, the Belgian waffles have become famous only the last few years,
I think,
in America. But, but no, I didn't know anything about it. I ran inside and looked it up in the World Book Encyclopedia as fast as I could, and two whole pages worth. So,
and mostly all Catholic, right, when it comes to religion.
That was one of the things I noticed. It was all Catholic, and that just sent a shiver down my spine because I thought, wow, you know, this is going to be really heroic, all those Catholics waiting to hear me. So, yeah, that was that even made it better in some ways.
I'm going to read just from the book here. Almost all Catholic. Now, that was the sort of challenge I had hoped for. You thought, wouldn't all those people in Catholic darkness be glad to see me? See the harder, farther, and newer mission, then the more heroic it was, not to mention the greater share of honor it would bring. Nice stuff. But, I mean, so what did you find when you actually traveled there? You went to Antwerp first?
Yeah, that's right. The headquarters was in Antwerp, and the mission itself was located in cities all around northern Belgium, the Dutch-speaking part of Belgium. And when I got there, I mean, people weren't as excited to see me as I thought. So that was a little surprising. And then kind of the theme of the book is learning how to deal with that. How do you deal with your high ideals and expectations just not being met? You know, what are your choices? And it's a good lesson to learn for all sorts of things in life. But certainly it hit me most in the face when I was there on a mission.
Yeah. Hey, Craig, I'm thinking if you're writing a memoir about something that happened to you when you're 19, you're looking back 30 years or more, you must be reflecting on what your mindset was at the time, what your attitude was at the time, how strong your belief system was at the time. So can you fill us in on that? What kind of a young Mormon were you at 19?
Oh, yeah. No, I wanted very badly to do everything right and live up to these expectations I'd imagined. There are certain missionary models, kind of heroes in Mormonism, you know, in scripture or, in, you know, living Mormons and so on. And so these are the people I wanted to be like. So, no, I really was fully invested in this and gave it everything I had. So that's another reason why it really hit me hard when things didn't go the way that I imagined they would go.
How did you imagine it? Before we get into how it actually went, I'm just trying to get a picture of what you really imagined would happen when you knocked on doors of homes in Belgium of people, mostly Catholic people.
Right. Well, I knew that not everybody could. Part of, you know, there's kind of a missionary narrative you have in your mind of how they all go or how every mission will go. And part of it was that, sure, it won't be easy. Not everybody is going to listen to you, but somebody's going to listen to you. In fact, maybe dozens will listen to you and want to convert and so on. And so that really was what I had in mind. And I, you know, I really had no sense. I've become a professor of European religion, and so I understand better why people convert nowadays. But at the time, I had none of that to think with, and I just imagined that people would recognize what I was saying was true and, you know, that their own religion wasn't. And that, I was quickly disabused of that idea. And again, later on, I came to understand this is a pretty simplistic way of looking at religion.
And before you went to Antwerp, did you get some training in how to handle rejection?
Oh, sure. You get a couple of months learning your language as a basis. You know, you just learn the basics, and you learn some proselytizing techniques. But most of it you learn on the, you know, you learn on the job, and you learn from your older, you know, the older missionaries, your senior companion, as it's called. So,
you know, this does give me a pause to reflect on the ability of people to sell door-to-door, people who have an ability to just talk to someone, take the rejection and just move on, whether they're telemarketers or door-to-door vacuum cleaner salesmen or whatever they're doing. They're out trying to sell advertising someplace. I've always thought that was a very hard thing to do and not for me, and you need a special part of your brain to function in order to do that.
Right.
Do you agree?
It was incredibly hard for some people, including me. I knew how to do it. I'd grown up in a big family. My dad was a real extrovert. And so I knew how to talk to people, including strangers, because my parents talked to strangers all the time. I mean, to the embarrassment of their kids sometimes. But I knew how to do it, but it still wasn't something that came easily to me. There were those who had it worse than I did. I mean, some people really could not get themselves to talk, and they would basically ride around on public transportation all day rather than actually talk to somebody. But most of us, and then there were a few people who were kind of born salesmen. And they were the ones, I think, who fit in best and knew how to do it best. Because it is a kind of soft sell, maybe in some cases hard sell. You're trying to persuade people. And that didn't come easily for many people, I think. But you still made yourself do it. You felt like that was just part of the job, and that's how I did it too. But I think doing it over and over, and it took its toll. Yeah.
Yeah. And what was your rap? How would you convince me or any other Catholic to consider converting to Mormonism?
Yeah, well, since I didn't really convert anybody, it didn't work very well.
But what was your plan? Can you give us a taste of your rap?
Right, you kind of knock on the door, you introduce yourselves, and if you do the hard sell, you say right away, you know, we are representatives of this church. But that never worked very well because the whole country was basically Catholic. Any religion that came from outside was considered foreign. In America, we're used to having multiple religions, and we're used to the idea even of people converting. But in a country like this, even if most people really weren't attending church or whatever, Catholicism was part of the social fabric. So anything outside of that was a threat, not just to their religion, it was more to their social standing. And I couldn't understand that at the time, but that's certainly a big part of the fear that they had. The other was that we look like CIA agents. You know, they hear our accents, they hear that we're Americans, and we're dressed up in suits, and they're immediately suspicious. You know, who are these guys? And they're trying to lead me away. So you would just try to, after a while, you learn just to try to be friendly. You know, we're from America. We're trying to learn your language. We're here to talk about, you know, religion and so on. And some people would want to talk further, but most didn't, right?
Did some people express admiration for at least showing up there for your efforts?
Oh, that was the great thing. One of the things I learned to love about Belgian people, they're very reserved at first introduction or sight. But once they get to know you, they're so kind. And one of the things they really admired was that you even tried to learn their Flemish language. No, you know, it's Dutch, basically Dutch. People, especially Americans, just didn't learn their language. And they were so stunned when any foreigner would try to learn their language. They were always used to adapting to other people's languages. So they love that. And that, I think that helped a lot. I think my colleagues in the French-speaking part of Belgium, that just wasn't appreciated nearly as much. But the fact that we did that, so they would at least talk to us about that. And the thing I learned over time was to be friends with them and learn to make friends with them. And when I started doing that and relaxing and not doing the hard sell, you know, toward the end of my time there, it was just so much more pleasant. And I stayed friends. I'm still friends with some of these people, you know, 40 years later.
Craig Harleen is our guest in this segment of Midday. His book, Way Below the Angels, one of the best subtitles we've read all year, the pretty clearly troubled but not even close to tragic confessions of a real live Mormon missionary. The publisher who is the publisher of this book?
Erdmans.
Erdmans. Yeah, I hadn't heard of them before. It's Erdmans.
That's right. They're from Michigan. Yeah,
Grand Rapids. I see that.
Mm-hmm.
So did you ever get into conversations with people who were actually curious about Mormonism in Belgium in the 1970s, sat you down in their home, maybe offered you a little schnapps or something that you couldn't drink, and then asked you questions about your religion?
Oh, sure they did. Yeah, no, you know, we'd work maybe 50 to 60 hours a week, stopping people on the street, going along the doors. And if you got in 3 to 7, 8 times a week for an hour-long discussion, you know, you're doing pretty well. And so there were certainly people who would do that. And I think a lot of them did it out of politeness, because they are very polite people, even though they are reserved and suspicious. Once they see you're friendly, they're very polite. So a lot of people would let us in for one conversation. Our goal was to have about 7 of them, you know, and then hopefully give them enough information that they'd want to convert. But but most of them would just let us in for that single conversation. But then others, you know, wanted to stay friends as well.
Did they understand or come to understand, those that you engaged, actually had conversations with, did they come to understand that your religion is Christian, that you're actually, you know, part of the Christianity?
Yeah, in their case, I mean, it's a little different in Belgium. In America, there's always an issue, you know, are Mormons Christian? In Belgium, Catholics call themselves Christians, and anybody else who was not Catholic was not Christian. So it's a little bit different context. But they mostly would consider it a heresy. I think the 70s were a difficult time. It was just after Vatican II, and plenty of Belgians were still trying to figure out their own Catholicism. Most of them were not practicing, but they were still strongly culturally Catholic. And so there were enough who were curious that they would talk to you about it in a kind of polite way. And there were some people who converted, not in my experience, but most of the time they, were just going to be polite to you.
Right. Craig, I'm curious about supervision of your missionary work.
Right.
Did you have to report to an authority each day about any success? Did you have to show someone a clipboard with a... showing how many addresses you had visited?
Right. Every mission has a mission president who's it's a couple, a man and a woman, man and wife. They're assigned to go to supervise the missionaries, basically. There might be 150, 200 missionaries in a mission. And so you report it every week, basically. You did send in a report every week with your activities.
Okay.
The week, yeah.
So... I'm going to recommend your book because it is an enjoyable read and humorous. But I don't think we're giving it away if we say Craig Harleen did not convert anyone, right? In fact, you admitted it a little while ago.
There was a kind of conversion. There was a ritual of conversion, and that's kind of leading to the climax of the book is that this woman all out of nowhere she wants to convert. And, of course, I'm dying to do this, but she really shows very little sign of knowing what she's getting into. So I'm completely torn about this because, of course, I want to convert her so I can go home and say I converted somebody. But because she shows no sign of knowing what she's getting into, I'm really hesitant to do this. And so that's kind of the big tension and the big drama, should I go ahead with this or should I not? And that kind of leads to the climax of the book.
You were being intellectually and spiritually honest. Right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
This person wasn't ready. Well. Right. I need to ask you, did you see the Book of Mormon?
I don't have anything against that except that it's a musical. I just don't like musicals. So that's. I did watch 9 or 10 of the videos or the music videos about it, so I knew what it was about. I could talk about it because I knew people would ask me about it. Mm-hmm. And they get some things amazingly right, about missionary work, I think, and challenges. And one of them is there's a song that's called It's About You and Me, But Mostly Me. Oh, that
right.
That they really get that one right. other things kind of have the tone of inside jokes being told by outsiders, like, maybe this is a good in-family joke. I'm not really comfortable with outsiders telling these kinds of jokes. But I have no problem with satire, and I think it is amazingly insightful in some ways. They talked to a lot of missionaries, I think, or at least they talked with those who gave them some good insight about missions.
And, Craig, the title of your book, Way Below the Angels, I like the title. Can you just tell us a little bit about that before we let you go?
Well, it's based on the biblical verse, he made them a little lower than the angels, and I just thought that had a nice poetic ring to it.
It does indeed. Well, thank you very much, Craig. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks for having me on the show, Dan.
Yeah, Craig Harleen, Harline, teaches European history at Brigham Young University. You can find a link to his website on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. His book, the one we've been talking about, a memoir about his missionary days with the Mormons called Way Below the Angels, the pretty clearly troubled but not even close to tragic confessions of a real-life Mormon missionary. You're listening to Midday here. More of our program when we get back. We'll take a little break here. When we come back, we'll turn to the phonograph and how it influenced African-American religion in the 1920s and 30s. Please stay with us. And welcome back to everyone. Dan Roderick's here. During this hour of the show, we're presenting three stories, each one of them tied to religion.
Oh, the little black saint is coming. Get all your business right. You better set your house in order.
That's the Reverend J.M. Gates, one of the most prolific and popular phonograph preachers of all time. My guest in this segment of the show is the religious commentator Lerone Martin, assistant professor of religion and politics at Washington University in St. Louis. In a new book, he looks at how the phonograph shaped modern African-American religion. Eager white Protestant clergy responded to the great migration that occurred in this country in the 1900s through the 1930s by taking old-time revivalism to radio, which was a new medium for an old message. Evangelical black clergy, in turn, harnessed the phonograph as an instrument for the urban revitalization of black Protestantism. Lerone Martin is the author of Preaching on Wax, The Phonograph and the Shaping of Modern African-American Religion. It's great to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Yeah, Lerone Martin, this is really interesting, and it's tied into the Great Migration, which I just mentioned there in brief for people who don't know. That we're talking about the movement of some 3 million African-Americans from rural South to city centers, cities and urban areas in the Midwest and the Mid-Atlantic and the Northeast from about 1900 to 1930, right?
Correct, and even extending after the war as well, really continued up until the 1960s and 1970s.
So the connection there, let's make this connection between your premise, your look at this bit of history of the phonograph and preachers and the Great Migration. So connect those for us, would you please?
During the Great Migration, as you can imagine, with any sort of shift in movement of people, there was a great deal of shifts and changes within American culture in terms of technology, in terms of domesticity, residential shifts. And as a result of this, obviously the role that religion played in people's lives also shifted and changed. Religious beliefs were challenged by new scientific knowledge, for example. And so many religious groups sort of confronted this in various different ways. Some began to sort of adjust their understanding of the Bible and to be in accord with new forms of science and knowledge. And other groups maintained their belief in the Bible as sort of the Word of God, if you will, as sort of being fundamentally true. And so there are various ways in which folks try to express that. In the book, what I talk about is the way that evangelicals didn't so much adjust their belief system or their belief in the Bible as a result of the Great Migration, but instead harnessed the new technology that became available during the 20s and 30s to maintain an old-time message, but to use new technology to proclaim it.
So was there a racial divide here? Did white preachers move to radio and black preachers used wax, records?
Exactly. In the 1930s, African Americans slowly began to get on radio. But prior to that, radio, like many new technologies in American history, was sort of staggered along racial and class lines. So as a result, African Americans or turned to the phonograph industry, which the phonograph industry was excited about this because as white Americans began to turn to radio, African Americans were still sort of connected to the phonograph in a way. And so it was a perfect match, if you will, a match made in heaven, if you will.
Yeah, I get you, Lerone. That's really interesting. So was the phonograph part of rural farm life, or did African Americans acquire phonographs when they got, you know, better jobs in factories, say in Pittsburgh or Baltimore, wherever they migrated to?
It was both. The phonograph was certainly in rural life, but also, according to the statistics we have, phonographs were also prominent in cities as well. There were African Americans, for the most part, not only did not have access to radio in terms of in the home in the early 1920s, but also there was not much African American entertainment on radio outside of several jazz and blues artists.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, there was both African Americans in the city and rural life had phonographs.
Lerone Martin is our guest. His book is Preaching on Wax. This is really interesting. The Phonograph and the Shaping of Modern African American Religion. Can we hear Reverend Gates again? Would you mind? I want to listen to this again, Lerone, and have you talk about him. He really produced a lot of these records. Go right ahead. Yeah,
play. Oh, the little black paint is coming. Get on.
So the Reverend Gates, who was from Georgia, I believe, he sang as well as preached, right? We've got him singing here. But he recorded his sermons.
Yes, he did. He recorded with several labels. He was the most productive and popular phonograph preacher of the era.
And so he would make a contract with the studio, and then these record albums would show up in record stores. Would people have to, or would people mail away for them? How were they distributed?
Well, he would was sought out after his popularity. He was sought after by record labels as far as Columbia, Paramount, OK Records, Vocalion. The list goes on, and even Victor RCA. And these records were distributed in all the above. You could buy them at a record store, furniture store, mail order catalogs. You could also, record companies would do business through the mail. They could be obtained just about anywhere. There's even stories of records showing up in country stores in rural America, as well as shoe shine parlors. I mean, they could be found pretty much anywhere.
Wow. And what about today? I mean, in doing the research for your book, did you meet any collectors of these albums?
I was actually fortunate enough to find some that are still being circulated. I even found the first one from 1925. I was able to find it at an auction, it's amazing to have. There are these, you know, shellac records that are made. They're pretty. They're hard. They're a little more. Than vinyl was, correct.
It's amazing. So here's another question for you. When we get to phonograph to radio, was there a period in the time that you're writing about here when some of these albums recorded by black clergy made it to radio, when radio stations decided, well, this is pretty popular, we'll put this on Sunday morning or Saturday evening?
Yes, some of them were played over the radio, and it was perfect timing because, as you know, with the technology of a 78 record, the sermons were only about 4 minutes per side, so it made perfect sense to have maybe to play one or two sermons in a 15-minute radio slot.
Wow. This went on, according to your tracking of it, these recordings were made up through World War II, is that right?
Yes. And the recording continued after World War II, particularly with people like Aretha Franklin's father, Reverend C.L. Franklin.
He recorded sermons. Did he also sing?
Yes, he did. Aretha Franklin's father did sing, and his preaching, much like Reverend Gates, was done and with a rhythmic cadence as well. And he had the benefit of the LP by the 50s and 60s, which allowed him to have his sermons to be significantly longer.
Lerone, how many of these have you been able to listen to in doing your research?
You know, to be honest with you, Dan, I've lost track.
I mean, you were talking about dozens, hundreds?
I've been able to listen to hundreds. Many of them actually, believe it or not, have been digitized. So you can go to YouTube or iTunes, Amazon, Document Records online. Many of these sermons have all been digitized, so they're all available to be heard.
Well, now I'm very curious to hear more of those. So we mentioned J.M. Gates, and you mentioned Aretha Franklin's father. Were there any other big names during this time?
The biggest, from what I can tell from research we've been able to tell in terms of orders of a sermon, was made by a man by the name of J.C. Burnett, and he had orders of almost 90,000 copies of a particular sermon called The Downfall of Nebuchadnezzar, and he was a Baptist preacher out of Kansas City.
Ah, so that particular sermon was really popular.
Correct.
Did you get to hear it?
I did. It starts off with a little bit of singing with the Reverend and his small congregation that's gathered in the studio, and then he preaches a rhythmic sermon about the downfall of Nebuchadnezzar.
Wow. Is it pretty dramatic? I mean, is it good, Lerone?
Huh? It's moving. I would say it's moving. Yes, sir.
You know, if a single preacher sold 90,000 copies of a singular recording, he must have made some money. He must have made money for his church.
Correct. So what I've been able to tell from the contracts and investigation is that many of these preachers were paid between $75 to $150 per sermon. So that's anywhere between roughly, we could say, the equivalent of $4,000 to $6,000 in terms of what that money would have meant to the preacher during that time.
Hmm. So,
And then also for those who were savvy enough to make sure they had a royalty agreement or a copy would gain the copyright to their sermon,
mm-hmm.
they would get royalties as well, anywhere between 1 to 2 cents a copy.
So that adds up. That's pretty good.
Oh, yes, during the 1920s.
By the 1920s or 30s, we are talking about the Great Depression for a lot of this, at least maybe 20 years of it, right?
Correct, absolutely. So the money added up, and for I can tell, for example, with Reverend Gates, he was able to drive, as a result of his career, he ends up buying several luxury cars, as a result moving into a very sizable home with all the amenities of the day, a garage, a gas stove, a telephone. And as a result, his life was changed as a result of being a popular phonograph preacher.
Has the Library of Congress done its part about preserving any of these?
Yes, there are several that have been preserved at the Library of Congress. I was able to get several artifacts from there, including the catalogs in which the sermons were sold. And there's pictures of these preachers selling their sermons right alongside Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong.
Hmm. Now, Laron, again, we're speaking with Laron Martin. His book is Preaching on Wax, the Phonograph and the Shaping of Modern African-American Religion. So there must have come a time then when black preachers, African-American preachers, moved directly to radio and started preaching there. Eventually, they got that opportunity, right?
Correct, they did. Several folks, particularly in the 1930s, in places like Chicago and New York, African-American preachers begin to get on radio in larger numbers, and even not just local radio, but national radio.
That's interesting, because I wonder about the ownership of those stations and how they behaved in terms of welcoming African-American preachers to their air. Or were these stations owned by African-Americans?
No. One of the most popular radio preachers of the era, Elder Lightfoot Solomon Michelle, for example, preaches on radio out of D.C., for over 30 years, and the radio station he goes on, the first radio station he goes on, is actually owned by a Klansman.
Was owned by a Klansman?
Yes, sir.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, he somehow convinced a local Klansman in D.C. that who owned a radio station to give him time on the radio, and as a result of the popularity of his numbers of listeners and letters coming in, the Klansmen agreed to let him stay on the radio, and the show became so popular when CBS came in and bought the station. The Columbia Broadcasting System came in and bought the station. They got rid of all the local shows except for Reverend Elder Michelle's show. It stayed on for over 30 years.
In D.C.?
Out of D.C., yes, sir.
Wow, that's that's quite a story there. That's the makings of a movie script or something. But I guess it shows that if you bring ears to the radio, if you bring in listeners and it can pay the bills, they'll keep you, right?
I think that's the one. I think that's certainly a way to look at it, yes,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah, boy, this sounds like a great adventure getting into this. And one last question for you before we let you go, Laron. How did you get into this topic?
Well, as a child growing up in industrial Ohio, northwest Ohio, I watched a lot of TV preachers with my family, and I was always curious as to how this idea of mass media religion and the selling of religion through various religious commodities, what the history behind it was. And as I matriculated through school, that's where I became interested in sort of tracing the story. And I wanted to find out particularly where African-Americans came into this story. And the literature that I had read mostly focused on white American preachers. And so that's what kind of led me to the phonograph.
Preaching on Wax, the Phonograph and the Shaping of Modern African-American Religion, the new book from Laron Martin, our guest in this segment of Midday. Laron is an assistant professor of religion and politics at Washington University in St. Louis. Well, it's great to have you. Thanks for opening our eyes and ears to this. Thank you very much, Laron.
Thanks for having me.
Yep. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our first hour of Midday. We'll take a break here for lunch. Our lunch today provided by Breathe Bookstore Cafe. Breathe Bookstore Cafe serves vegetarian, vegan, and gluten-free savory sweets, coffee, tea, juices, and more. Breathe Bookstore Cafe is open 7 days a week and located on the Avenue in Hamden. Thanks for tuning into this first hour of Midday. A break now for the news, and then we'll see you for the second hour.